7:43. So US President Donald Trump's claim last week that South Korea won't ease unilateral sanctions against North Korea without Washington's approval has led to a great deal of contention, as it was deemed an infringement of Seoul's sovereignty. But just yesterday at high-level talks in Panmunjom, the two Koreas agreed to launch projects to connect border roads and railways as early as late November. We're now joined by a very distinguished guest, Professor Victor Cha from Georgetown University, author of several books, including The Impossible State, updated edition, North Korea Past and Future, and Power Play, The Origins of the American Alliance System in Asia. He also served as National Security Council Director of Asian Affairs under former President George W. Bush. In other words, was a key North Korea advisor to him. Thank you very much for joining us today on the line.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
If we go back to that quote again, they do nothing without our approval. It looked very much as if President Trump was speaking with the confidence of someone who is asked for permission every time South Korea wants to do anything significant on North Korea. Is that how we should be reading that?
Well, this president has a unique way of expressing himself. And I think what it more broadly reflects is that there is a consensus in the United Nations and among the community of nations that until there are real, tangible steps towards denuclearization, there should be no premature lifting of sanctions. I think certainly it's a view held in Washington, D.C., among some in Seoul, obviously not all in Seoul. And when I travel to Europe, it's actually a view held by many Europeans who feel like there needs to be a real diminishing of the nuclear threat and an improvement in the human rights situation, because those are exactly what the sanctions are on North Korea for. So I think that's what it was reflecting, although probably you might have said it in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, it was a strongly worded statement, which he repeated. But if we look just a little bit closer at the background to this, these are unilateral sanctions. These are sanctions that South Korea imposed by its own desire after those attacks in 2010. There's no legal obligation at all to the U.S., is there, to seek approval or the backing of the international community?
No, of course, these are the, if you're talking about the sanctions that South Korea imposed after the Cheonan sinking and the artillery exercises and other North Korean provocations, these are certainly within the purview of South Korea to remove. It is more complicated now because there are now overlapping UN Security Council sanctions that would make, for example, a reopening of Kaesong Industrial Complex, which was closed by unilateral measures by the South, would make a reopening of that potentially a violation of new UN Security Council resolution sanctions. So while there are, you know, there are unilateral sanctions that South Korea in the past has put on North Korea, and has actually had conditions for lifting, including admitting to the Cheonan sinking, apologizing for other provocations. Those might, on paper, be able to be lifted, but they might also be in violation of UN Security Council resolutions.
Yeah, well, it sort of makes lifting them a symbolic step if there are areas of overlap. Some might say anyway. But it doesn't help the alliance situation. What's your view of the health of the relationship between Seoul and Washington?
So I would say overall it's still a very strong relationship. I mean, the relationship from a U.S. perspective, the relationship with South Korea is one of those alliances that are a true measurement of the success of the Cold War. I mean, you know, South Korea is now a country that provides lots of non-security benefits to the United States as a military partner of the United States, in addition to the security situation on the peninsula and the region more broadly. I think Moon and Trump have a good working relationship. They're both after the same thing, which is some resolution of this North Korean threat problem. I wouldn't say that the degree of trust is very high between the two leaders, because you know, they're coming from really opposite ends of the spectrum, trying to deal with a similar problem, and for the moment they have a very similar sort of tactic, which is this effort in engaging North Korea. We just have to think a year ago when the two had very different views on how to deal with this. One of them, President Trump in particular, was talking about military action, and the South Koreans were worried that they were going to get entrapped into some sort of conflict between the United States and North Korea.
But do you believe that Donald Trump ever has seriously had a strategy on North Korea? Because even his own words suggest that all that talk of a bloody nose strategy, for example, and going for a preemptive strike, that they were words to threaten North Korea into dialogue.
So I think he has the same strategy for North Korea that he has for Iran, that he has for China, that he has for everyone else, which is to put a lot of pressure on in the beginning, almost pushing to the edge, if not pushing right over the edge, and then to see if there can be some negotiation room that can be created out of de-escalating. I mean, we saw him do this with North Korea in 2017, pushing very close to the edge. If any of your listeners have read the Woodward book, you'll see that he pushed very, very close to the edge. That could have inadvertently started a war. And in China, we see with the escalation of the trade dispute, again, pushing very, very far forward, but at the same time saying that he has a good relationship with the Chinese leader and that they can do business if they want to. So I think it's a very similar sort of strategy that he's pursuing. I mean, some people might not say it's a strategy. They might say it's more of a tactic, almost more of a business tactic than it is a strategy, and they might be right in saying that. But you know, it's the only thing that we have right now in dealing with the North Koreans. The North Koreans, you know, they want to deal with South Korea, China, but they really want to deal with the United States. So in many ways, we're stuck with this tactic that the president is pursuing, you know, which will probably lead at some point to a second summit between Kim and Trump.
Just briefly on that bloody nose issue, I can't help mentioning your much-cited opinion piece that you wrote and was published in the Washington Post at the end of January. Presumably at that time you felt that was a message that needed to be heard within the Trump administration, that really it's a very dangerous thing to be playing with fire.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, the notion that one could carry out a limited military strike and that this would not lead to a dramatic escalation, if not all-out war, possibly even including nuclear weapons, it was just too huge an assumption that somehow North Korea would be deterred from responding. So I felt compelled to offer my opinion on this, and despite whatever the consequences would be.
Well, we know one of the consequences was that you didn't become the U.S. ambassador to South Korea. But was that ever actually very close to happening?
Yeah, I mean, yes, it was, and that's all past old history now. I mean, yes, they had asked me to do the job, and we were basically finished with the process. But look, every president, he or she chooses their ambassadors, and they, just as they choose them, they also have a right at the very last minute to change their mind, which is what happened in my case. And but I'm okay with that.
Understand. And you continue to be an ambassador of sorts for inter-Korean relations, given the wealth of your writing. Do you still feel there's a lot to say on this issue, even as it seems to go through this endless cycle between administrations, either conservative or reaching out for dialogue, and now we have Trump throwing in a bit of a spanner?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. One can go mad watching this at some point, because it does look like it's a replay of things we've seen in the past. But I do feel it's different now, because there is, you know, homeland security threat posed by North Korea, which was not the case before, which has the effect of making this a front burner issue for the United States in a way it hasn't been before. And in addition, we are really testing the hypothesis now that was a criticism levied at past negotiators, including myself, which is that the United States was never willing to talk directly to the leader of North Korea because he's the only one who makes a decision. We are actively testing that hypothesis right now to see if that, in fact, will lead to a different conclusion. So I feel like one way or another, as strange as everything seems with regard to summits and love letters and all these other sorts of things, We are really going to be in uncharted territory whether all of this succeeds, right, in terms of a second summit, denuclearization, peace declaration, or whether it fails in terms of the two leaders being unable to reach some sort of agreement and declaring that the negotiations are a failure. Either way, I think we're headed for uncharted territory. And so I think, you know, all of us who watch this are watching it very closely.
Now, you do have a number of publications. Just to talk about a couple of them, we've got Power Play, published in 2016, The Origins of the American Alliance System in Asia, very relevant to the way that things are playing out now with the various interests in this region. But we've also got the updated edition of The Impossible State, one of your very famous books. Can you tell us a bit more about both of those?
Sure. So Power Play it's more of an academic book, and it's really focused on the origins of the U.S. alliance system in Asia, going back to Kennan and Acheson and Dulles, Truman and Eisenhower, looking at Japan, Korea, and Taiwan. The Impossible State was the first book that came out after the death of Kim Jong-il, trying to assess what would happen under Kim Jong-un. And then 5 years later, the press asked me to do an update where we added a chapter not so much on North Korea, but really on Trump and Trump's policy. That chapter is aptly entitled Whiplash, and it's a fun read. I mean, I that's what I've been told, looking at how the administration has swung wildly from threats of fire and fury in 2017 to love letters in 2018.
If we can finish with a little forecast of how things are likely to play out, we had inter-Korean talks yesterday, agree to reconnect border roads and railways. But last time we saw the Koreas just want to survey the railroad situation, there was a problem with the United Nations command. Is the U.S. likely to allow that little bit of cooperation this year?
It's a good question. I think it'll really be dependent on whether there are denuclearization steps that qualify for sanctions relief. I should say that I understand part of the reason why the South Koreans are pushing this so hard. You know, they want to keep the diplomatic momentum going, and particularly on the rail and infrastructure links, road links. You know, I think they want to have a first mover advantage because there's always a specter of Chinese involvement in North Korea's infrastructure rejuvenation, which I think for South Koreans is really anathema to how they envision the future of the peninsula. So I think that, you know, there are a number of factors there. It's not simply, you know, pulling against the collar of the United States. They're thinking long-term about China's role on the peninsula as well.
Yeah.
But in the immediate term, you know, I think a lot of it does have to do with whether, you know, in the steps leading to eventually to the second Kim-Trump summit, whether the North Koreans offer stuff on denuclearization that really qualifies for sanctions relief. And then some of these inter-Korean projects can go forward.
Dr. Victor Cha, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.